Paul, the Apostle by Grace, by Brother John Mitchell. Chapter 18, Athens. Paul and Silas's nocturnal flight from Thessalonica, on account of the civil authorities' pressure upon them as troublemakers, brought them, after a journey of at least 3 days, to Berea. There, notwithstanding the treatment they'd received in both Philippi and Thessalonica, they took up their preaching activities again. On arriving, they went to the Jewish synagogue, says Luke. Now the Bereans were of more noble character than the Thessalonian Jews had been, for they received the message with great eagerness, and examined the scriptures every day to see if what Paul had said was true. And the result of this first reference to the benefit of the daily readings to increase faith in the gospel was that many of the Jews believed, as did also a number of prominent Greek women and many Greek men. Just how long this happy and, for Paul and Silas, encouraging state of affairs lasted is not stated. But when news of it travelled back along the road to Thessalonica, the spleen of the Jews in the synagogue there knew no bounds. Such as were able to make the long trek south went to Berea to repeat their previous performance by agitating the crowds and stirring them up, especially against Paul. The newly converted brethren in Berea reacted quickly and, rather than evoke official censure, considered it wise to evacuate Paul and, in the kindliest way, to escort him down the coast of Greece to the safety of Athens. At the same time, they showed their nobility once more and their loyalty to the faith by retaining Silas and Timothy a little longer to help in the consolidation of their new ecclesia. Paul, however, felt he needed them, and when the Berean escorts returned from Athens, they brought his instructions that Silas and Timothy should join him as soon as possible. While he waited for them for perhaps a fortnight or so, Paul spent his time reasoning with the Jews and proselytes in the local synagogue, apparently without much success, and preaching in the marketplace with equally negative results. Otherwise he went on sampling the sights and sounds of the city alone, and inevitably found them depressing. Even for a Jew brought up in the diaspora, whose boyhood and early youth had been spent amongst the idol worshippers of Tarsus, the concentration of shrines and monuments was shocking. There were said to be more statues in Athens than in all the rest of Greece put together, which, although viewed by many as the perfection of Greek art, was abhorrent to the Jewish mind for what it represented in both body and spirit. More lonely than Wordsworth's poetic cloud, Paul was distressed to see so many idols as he wandered through the streets of this famous city, now fallen into decay. Until one day he came upon an altar that bore the inscription, "To the Unknown God." It had no doubt been erected by the fearful, lest in ignorance they should have left out one God from their pantheon. How long Paul meditated before it, we do not know, but when he turned away there was a glint in his eye, because he felt he had at last found a line he could use to bring the knowledge of the only true God to these heathens who surrounded him. In the marketplace there was never a shortage of listeners, for all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time discussing and disputing the latest philosophical ideas with whoever would propound them. Especially prominent in this Hyde Park Corner kind of debate were the Epicureans, who maintained that the highest good was pleasure, and the Stoics, who asserted that the highest good was virtue. When Paul turned up again in the Agora and began to speak from some coign of vantage, for he was a small man, representatives of the two philosophical groups gathered round him in a contemptuous kind of way to put him to the test. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler?" That's literally a bird that feeds on scraps, trying to say. Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods," because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then, as much in intellectual conceit as in curiosity, the Epicureans and the Stoics persuaded Paul to accompany them to the traditional place on Mars Hill known as the Areopagus, where in the heyday of Greece all matters affecting the state religion were decided. "May we know what this new teaching is that you are presenting?" they asked. "You're bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we want to know what they mean." There was, of course, nothing official about the meeting. It was more of a burlesque, but it provided Paul with his first opportunity to preach the gospel to an attentive audience. So he said, "Men of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Now, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples made by hands. And he is not served by human hands, as if he needed anything, because he himself gives all men life and breath and everything else. From one man he made every nation of men, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he determined the time set for them and the exact places where they should live. God did this so that men would seek him, and perhaps reach out for him and find him. So he's not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by man's design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. And he has given proof of this to all men by raising him from the dead. Thus, in a few bold strokes with just a touch of knowledge of Greek literature to prove that he was not an ignoramus, Paul gave a masterly presentation of the greatness of the Almighty, and he obliterated the significance of all other gods and the wisdom of those who worship them. And the proof of the truth was all this, and the truth of all this was the resurrection of God's appointed one from the dead, a verifiable event no other religion or philosophy has ever matched or ever could. The reaction of these worldly wise philosophers was predictable. The immortality of the soul, as discussed by Socrates and his friends while he awaited the death sentence, they had known, thanks to Plato, for 400 years. But the resurrection of the body and facing the judgment of God, that was another matter. And when they heard about it, some of them sneered, while others said disingenuously, "We'll hear you again on this matter." Whereupon Paul left them. However, a few members of the audience did become followers of Paul, including Dionysius, an Areopagite counsellor, and a woman named Damaris. But after so disappointing an encounter with the famed wisdom of the Greeks, Paul felt it was time to move on. Not waiting for Silas and Timothy to catch up with him, he decided to leave this graveyard of the gods and to go to Corinth instead, with its unsophisticated humanity in the raw, and to preach to them.